Hey, what's going on? Welcome to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. And Julia, they have your Twitter handle wrong. When we come on to the show, I just noticed.
Really?
I didn't even notice. This is how locked in I am on what things look like on TV that our Twitter handles even go up there.
It's been like that since started?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. I just saw it right now. There's a typo in there.
I can't.
This is how much you're on social media these days.
Yeah. Listen, you know, you search my name, you will find my Twitter account. That's not a problem, but don't expect much. I'm mostly a retweet girly these days.
It's more or less dormant.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, there's life outside of Twitter, and people kind of know where to find me if they want to read my stuff or listen to my voice. I don't know.
Social media, bad place for the most part.
It is for the most part. Listen. It's good because I live far away from my family, obviously. Everyone is in Brazil, and so something like Instagram is nice to sort of keep in touch with everyone. But I have found very little use for Twitter, especially when things aren't going as well for the Blue Jays they should. Although, series win.
Yes, it is. You know, I got to get jokes off. So we come on the show, and like I have to be like relatively serious.
Yes.
Not entirely, like... I mean, if you saw me on Blue Jay Central the other night and how Danielle Michaud introduced my segment, you know, I don't have to be serious all the time.
Danielle really opened my eyes to how irresponsible it was of me to give you a tub of Brazilian coffee and send you off to do Blue Jay Central.
But here I am with non-Brazilian coffee, and who wants that?
Yeah, sorry about that. I need to be better. I need to be more consistent with
my coffee.
We do
not need to establish that you have to bring me a coffee every single day. You can bring me one coffee for every run the Jays score in a week. So that doesn't even work out to one a day.
Wow.
It does, actually. So they scored two yesterday. The Jays win 2-0 against the Rangers. And all sorts of weird feeling throughout this one because we know the offense is not particularly good right now. Coming into a series decider 1-1, you squandered a really good Bowden Francis start the day before. You couldn't get anything going offensively. This is another team that's kind of struggling. You feel like you got the win, but it's a bullpen day. And then the further the bullpen day goes on and the offense hasn't been able to add anything, however well the pitchers are pitching in a bullpen day, you don't expect to throw a shutout. You don't expect to throw a one-hitter and neutralize, yes, a bad Rangers lineup, but a Rangers lineup that has a lot of the same pieces still as the World Series champion in 2023, who got Corey Seager back in the lineup yesterday. You expect to need some offense, and they got zero offense until there were two outs in the ninth inning. Bo Bichette with a pinch hit home run to win it. So the Jays win the series. And before we get into the specifics of the game, they just won a series, Julia, in which they scored four runs total.
Yeah, we can't expect that to happen
ever
again. I mean, at least this series or this season, right? It is very much because the Rangers are in a hole that is somehow deeper than the Blue Jays that we are able to talk about this in this way right now. It's not winning baseball. I will say that, you know, last night my biggest concern was, okay, this is a bullpen day, and so there are so many more variables to consider. But the Blue Jays had a lot more chances than the Rangers. And so, you know, if you want to play the numbers game and in the middle of it, I was like, well, I need to find some motivation to watch this game until the end with the way that things are going and the amount of squandered opportunities that the Blue Jays are having here. And that to me was it. It was like, they are reaching base. They are, you know, quote unquote, doing everything more or less right in order to put themselves in that position. Whereas the Rangers were doing nothing. They had nothing going on. It was Josh Smith and no one else. And so that sort of allows you to dream of a series win with just four runs scored, right?
Josh Smith had, he led off the game with a hit, which was the only hit the Rangers would get for the entire day. They went 0 for 27 after that. He also had two of the three walks that the Rangers had. So he was responsible for three of the four base runners that the Rangers got. He was also the only Ranger to reach second base, which he just did himself and stole a base off of Eric Lauer. It was basically just Josh Smith. Alejandro Osuna, who's had a really nice debut week here, drew the other walk, but pretty much no trouble. And it's pretty remarkable. I talked after the Tuesday game when Nathan Eovaldi left, and I kind of made the point, you know, you had said, well, Jacob Latz and the rest of the guys did a good job. And I this ends up being very relevant. I was like, well, imagine how you would feel if the Blue Jays did that to a team. You would, yes, appreciate the job Paxton Schultz and Eric Lauer and Braden Fisher did, but you'd be doing backflips that they shut out even a bad lineup. And that is what happened. Paxton Schultz and Eric Lauer and Braden Fisher and Brandon Little and Jeff Hoffman combined for this one hitter with only four base runners overall. Low stress, not low stress because it was 0-0, so everything felt tense. But in terms of like no one really had to pitch out of the stretch, no one got in a jam. It was all, everyone was pretty pitch efficient. Like even Eric Lauer, who went 3 1/3, only threw 41 pitches, so conceivably available on the weekend. It went almost literally as well as a bullpen day could go.
Yeah, and this is a group that I feel is unheralded in many ways, Blake, but the Blue Jays bullpen has been a bright spot for this team. I know that there was somewhat of a rough stretch in which Jeff Hoffman was not pitching very well, and Jimmy Garcia had his troubles, and now obviously he's on the IL. But the Blue Jays keep finding these guys that are giving them a chance to win. I can't say enough good things about Paxton Schultz and the way that he went about it. When he came out, I was a tad bit surprised, and you know, clearly that was the plan. It was one time through the order, but you know, in my mind, I was like, well, plans can change, and he's pitching very well.
Also, his first start though of the season at any level.
Yeah, I understand, right? It worked out, which is great. But when Eric Lauer walked, I believe it was Josh Smith.
Of course, it was Josh
Smith. His first at bat there, I was like, well, you know, you kind of wonder. But he locked in. He did the job. So did everyone else behind him, and that is why the Blue Jays needed just one clutch hit with two outs in the top of the ninth.
Yeah,
to get this done.
The bullpen being good. So the Jays are 11th in reliever ERA at 3.57 overall. And that's not exactly what you're talking about. It's more the guys who have been able to come in and give some length and things like that. I mean, 3.57 ERA as a team is very good anyway. And then you look and like what they've done with the, so Kevin Gausman, Jose Berríos, Chris Bassett, Bowden Francis have all made 11 starts. And then what you look at what's happened in all the other spots. You know, Eric Lauer gave them one good one, one rough one. Jose Reyna gave them one good one, one rough one. The Yariel opener day didn't go that well. And then the Paxton Schultz opener day went pretty well. So you've got to cobble together with the fifth spot, and you've got to cobble together with these kind of bullpen days. And we'll talk about this in a little bit. They're going to cobble together the fourth spot in the rotation this weekend as well. They're going to juggle things and use the Monday off day to get some guys some extra rest to separate the Bowden Francis day from the Eric Lauer / Paxton Schultz / Jose Urena day in the bullpen. Let's talk about the lone offense that the Blue Jays got though. So it was, as you laid out, very much the same game that we've seen a few times lately. Through 8 2/3 innings, the Jays had 7 hits and 3 walks, but they were 0-for-8 with runners in scoring position. They had stranded 8 base runners, so that stretched their slump to 3 for their last 44 with runners in scoring position, averaging a runner left on base per inning. So in this one, start the game, Varsho leads off with a walk, immediately a race with a double play.
Yeah.
Fourth inning, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and George Springer both walk with only one out. They get nothing. Fifth inning, Nathan Lucas singles, manages to get around to third on ground outs, doesn't score. The sixth inning, Vlad singles and Addison Barger has this weird bloop double, but because it's a bloop double, it's not enough to score Vlad from first. Those guys get stranded. The seventh, Nathan Lucas again leads off with a single, steals a base, gets stranded. In the seventh, we also saw your boy Hobie Milner for the third day in a row come in for a lefty-lefty matchup against Dalton Varsho.
He faced Dalton Varsho all three games.
Side note here, Dalton Varsho is 1-for-15 on the season against lefties now, and the one hit is that drag bunt.
That sounds about right.
It hasn't been great, so I think we're going to see that a little bit more, and obviously something the Jays can do to insulate that is, you know, their righties hit a little better and you sandwich them in the lineup so that it's dangerous if you bring in a lefty versus Dalton Varsho and he doesn't get him out, then Anthony Santander is there or something like that, as the way the order worked last night, on the righties a little bit to protect him there. So all of that sets up the ninth inning. No one feels good about where the Blue Jays are at. Ernie Clement leads off with a single. Nathan Lucas sacrifices him to second base. So you got two cracks at a single to try to score Ernie Clement. Alejandro Kirk pinch hits for Ali Sanchez and flies out. And then Bo Bichette pinch hits for Michael Stefanik. Bo Bichette was out of the lineup. He's never out of the lineup.
Yeah.
He was dealing with back tightness. And John Schneider said after the game that around the sixth inning, it had gotten better throughout the day, but they held him out as a precaution. Around the sixth inning, Bo Bichette goes to them, and says, I can go pinch hit, defensive replacement, whatever. Bo Bichette had only, prior to this time, pinch hit twice in his career because he starts every game. And he was 0 for 2. What did you think in the moment? Like, take me through you watching this inning a little bit.
Well, I think we need to kind of go back to what Bo being out of the lineup did for this lineup, which is we saw a significant shuffle, right? We saw Vladdy at number 3, Varsha was leading off, Santander number 2. And this is something that we have sort of clamored for. Let's try to mix it up and see what happens. The results were not very promising, but there's really nothing quite like having Bo Bichette hit in the 9 hole, which is what I've always said is what was going to work.
Yes.
Right? But listen, it's not easy to do. He spoke to Arden after the game, and he's saying, well, it was just another at bat. Sure it was, but you've been cold. You've been watching from the dugout all game. You understand how big this at bat truly is, and coming in and being that locked in, it was a mistake pitch. There's no doubt about it. It was a changeup that just stayed in the zone. But Bo was ready for it, which is not something that has been a guarantee for even the star hitters in this lineup right now. So good sign. And I got to say, I was kind of shocked to see Bo, because we know how conservative the Blue Jays can be when it comes to injured players and things of those sorts. But one, you trust Bo Bichette to tell you the truth, that he's ready to go and that he feels fine. And two, they really, really needed a pinch hitter for Michael Stefanik in that situation. That's a given here, right?
Yeah, and again, they're about to face the Athletics for 4 games in a row. They'll see 3 lefty starters. They haven't seen a lefty starter since May 7th, and they're near the bottom of the league in plate appearances against left-handed pitching. This is why I will revisit the point we talked about the other day, is that David Schneider is supposed to be on this show tomorrow. I would not be surprised if there is a Stefanik for David Schneider roster move, if we see Jonathan Clase in there more, just because, yeah, you don't want Michael Stefanik hitting in leverage, and the bench is not particularly well suited for a string of lefty pitchers. So maybe something there. But yeah, so you pinch it and Bo Bichette comes in there, and it's pretty high leverage.
Yeah.
It is 0-0 with 2 outs in the 9th. That is, you're imagining a game in your backyard and monkey hitting. And yeah, it's, that's the situation. 2 outs in the 9th, and you got to come up with, he only needed to come up with a homer. He obviously comes up with a single, comes up with a homer instead. I looked for context, the leverage index, which just like measures how much a game could swing on one at bat, was the 5th highest ever for a Blue Jays pinch hit home run. It's the highest since 1999. Otto Velez in 1977 has the record. I have no context of the 1977 Toronto Blue Jays whatsoever. I'm much too young. So the highest leverage pinch hit home run for the Blue Jays since 1999. There have been some other pinch hit home runs in big spots. Spencer Horwitz last September came in down 1-0 against the Braves in the 8th and hit a 2-run shot. Ernie Clement early last year had one against the Yankees where he came in with a solo shot in a tied game, but that one was only the 7th inning, not the 9th, right? Like Bo's coming in. Ezekiel Carrera did it a couple times in the 2015-2016 seasons. He had a couple big ones. And then overall, ignoring the pinch hit aspect of it, this was the second highest leverage shot of the Blue Jays season after only Vlad hitting a 3-run bomb against Boston when they were down 2-1 back in May. So all of that is to say, mostly that I like to play around and go remember some old fun home runs.
Yeah.
But the leverage does not get much higher than tie game, 2 out in the 9th. And the stats can't quantify this, but late in a bullpen day, in a series decider, when your team has not played particularly well and is around 500, the vibe leverage index was even further through the roof.
Yeah, when we can quantify that, it will be a true breakthrough. And it's been tough to, kind of analyze Bo Bichette's season up to this point. We know that he's hitting the ball hard. We know that he is doing well in the leadoff spot. And also, we kind of see that he isn't just yet the hitter that has found so much success and led the league in hits 2 years in a row with the Blue Jays earlier before the injury last year and all the time lost. Obviously, this may still be someone who is working his way back to full form and to full rhythm. And, it takes guys a different amount of time. to get there, especially having missed as much time as he did and just in, you know, in kind of a heartbreaking way really last year. But when he comes up in those situations and gives you a Bo Bichette at bat, which is he saw two pitches and he hammered the one that was a mistake, then you start to feel pretty good about what it is that he can give you, you know, to wrap up this first half and beyond, because the Blue Jays are still a contending team and they are going to need Bo Bichette. Is he the leadoff hitter for the rest of the way? I still don't know, but it's good to see. And it's honestly very good for the player as well to sort of, you know, remind himself that this is what he is capable of. And it doesn't really matter if he goes on a stretch of five games without a hit or whatever it may be. He is still in a good spot and doing all the right things to put himself in those types of situations, Blake.
Yeah, and it's certainly nice to see that the power has been a little bit more regular of late. He's hit five home runs in the 20 or so games since that 65-game homerless streak ended. It is funny you mentioned him having led the league in hits before, and I looked it up, and he's 10th in the league in hits, even though he's only hitting 273. He gets up a lot. He obviously hits a lot. Aaron Judge has 81 already, so I don't think Bo Bichette is going to lead the league in hits this year. He's already 18 behind because Aaron Judge is hitting 391 still. You mentioned you don't know if Bo Bichette is in the leadoff spot. Now, yesterday was against a right-handed pitcher, and it was an off day for Bo Bichette because of the back tightness, but we did see the Blue Jays shake up their lineup, and I'm curious if you think we're going to see some form of that tonight. So for anyone who missed it, Dalton Varsho led off, was followed by Anthony Santander, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., George Springer, Addison Barger. I think against three lefty starters in 4 days, you can pretty much lock in that Dalton Varsho is not going to lead off. I don't think that's going to be the answer. What do you expect this to look like tonight?
I don't know. I honestly don't know because, you know, obviously when you don't have Bo Bichette in the lineup, you need to do something and you need to rejig somehow. Didn't really expect to see Varsho, Santander, Vlad, Springer. It was nice to see Vlad back in the number three spot, which, you know, vocally, it is his preferred spot. I didn't really understand having Varsho and Santander hitting number one, number two. Varsho, number one, made sense. He's done it before for the Blue Jays. Santander has not been swinging particularly well from the right side. And so, you know, I don't really...
It was a righty starter, so he was hitting from the left side.
Yeah, he was. But if you want to, like, sort of separate things, I don't know. It was a weird one. He's not swinging the bat well regardless right now. He's still swinging and missing a ton. He's still having trouble with the high fastball. But whatever. You need to try something, and on paper at least, he is one of your best hitters, right?
Yeah. Like, I understand the idea of trying to get Vladimir Guerrero Jr. into the three spot because he's hitting well for average and he doesn't have a lot of RBI. He has not come up a lot with guys, you know, on base for him and things like that. But it is tough when the two guys ahead of you have like 225 OBPs. And Varsho's obviously been awesome this season from a power perspective, but he's not a guy who is creating traffic on the bases particularly often. Anthony Santander is not doing much of anything to put guys on the bases. So I'll be very curious tonight if they go Bichette, Santander, Guerrero as a 1-2-3, or if they go back to the way things were. In general, I don't like Santander struggling so much. You moved him down in the lineup, it didn't fix it, so you move him up in the lineup. Like, I don't think putting him in a more premium spot and getting an extra plate appearance here and there is going to fix things. But also, as we've talked about, and as I mentioned, anytime batting order stuff comes up, you need multiple guys to be hitting well for that to matter. And if George Springer's not hitting well, if Anthony Santander's not hitting well, if you're about to face three straight lefties, so you don't want Dalton Varsho in your top three, because again, he's 1-for-15 against lefties this year and they've protected him against lefties where they can. You know, Addison Barger has been better lefty on lefty, but I don't think he's going to hit in your top three. So there are not a lot of good answers when no one's hitting particularly well.
Yeah, there have been some very good at-bats and encouraging at-bats from Addison Barger against lefties, and then there have been some terrible at-bats. So, again, hard to know sort of what to expect. I would think we would see a little bit more of Jonathan Class A. I am shocked by how little he's played since having a good performance his last few times out.
Yeah, and we talked about it with Dan Shulman on Monday. We kind of all were in agreement that you'd like to see a little bit more. We got questions in the text line about him even leading off. So I would imagine we'll see more of him with three lefties in 4 days. But if they just iced him for three games, not even a pinch run, not even a pinch hit, it is hard to imagine if they put him back in there, they will do so at the top of the lineup. I just don't think they see Jonathan Class A the way that we discussed it Monday. Or who knows? Maybe it was just a random, we didn't play him for 3 days, but the evidence certainly indicates they do not rate him that highly. The Addison Barger of yesterday was very funny too, by the way. This is not how regression is supposed to work and things are supposed to balance out in the long run, but he ropes a single, then he hits a fly ball that is an out, but it would have been out of four ballparks, and then he bloops a double, which is like his softest hit ball of the season. And then he had another like laser out later on. So he ends up with three really hard hit balls, two hits. So like that seems fair.
Yeah.
But the one hit that dropped in for extra bases was by like one of his worst batted balls of the season.
Yeah.
Pretty funny how all that evens out just in one game.
I have to admit that, you know, you don't think of bloop doubles very often. And I was like, well, I guess such a thing does exist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Blue Jays haven't hit the grass as much as they would like with batted balls like that. But you'll take it. It didn't really amount to anything because obviously the struggles have continued. But Addison Barger has been a bit of a bright spot here, Blake. The problem is that you never really know what you're going to get still. I think that he is working his way towards, you know, warranting more confidence from this staff and from his manager. But there are still some pretty ill-advised at-bats mixed in with the very, very good ones that we're getting from him.
Yeah, he has 342 career plate appearances.
He's going to be fine.
Yes, that's a young guy figuring it out. And at least things like, you know, the things we can touch, like the chase rate and things like that are in reasonable range. So sometimes it looks bad. I think that's a byproduct of you have a big, powerful swing as well. So when you miss, you're going to miss.
Yeah.
Is going to miss a little worse.
that's fair. You know what? Maybe the eye test is a little weird with the
guy. Yeah, like similar to Varsho, right? Like when he misses. But it's because you're, you know, swinging with some intent there. So shout out to the bullpen. Paxton Schultz, 2 2/3. Eric Lauer, 3 1/3. Braden Fisher, 1 1/3. And those three, basically, other than Arena, kind of your lowest leverage arms, cobble together, 7 1/3 shutout innings. And then Brendan Little comes in for just two batters and strikes them both out, of course. It's Brendan Little. By the way, here's a stat related to the bat tracking stuff we talked about the other day. So Alex Chamberlain, who is at Fangraphs and Baseball Prospectus, has done some sciencey stuff that is above my head. But the takeaway is that because of the bat tilt and all this new data, we can start to approximate how much a hitter missed by.
Okay.
And try to, like, Baseball Prospectus, the guy who runs their Stuff Plus and things like that, the guy who's doing all the work behind the scenes, you know, is trying to model based on the swing, here's where a player expected the ball to be, here's what the player expected the velocity to be. Like, we can start to kind of guess at that stuff. And using that stuff, Alex Chamberlain ran a query of basically which pitchers are making batters miss the worst. And based on, and again, it's early with all this data, but nobody is making batters miss worse versus their expect, like where their swing actually comes in versus where it should have been, than Brendan Little, which is a pretty, again, not a neat enough way for me to explain it well, because the physics of it and the math of it is a little above my head. But the outcome of Brendan Little is making guys miss worse than anyone in baseball certainly lines up with the way it's looked anytime he's got that knuckle curve working.
Yeah, it is very much, I guess, another statement of how dominant that pitch has been. That is not a mirage. It doesn't seem like it is going anywhere. I understand that the sample is still relatively small. You want to see how things progress. I think it's good that, you know, after the amount of pitches that he threw against the Padres here in Toronto, that he got
a week off.
Exactly, basically. And you can see that he was well rested for those two batters in a very, very important spot in the game, with Jonah Heim pinch hitting for the Rangers. Was it Braden Fisher in there before him?
Yeah.
So they wanted to turn Heim around to bat from the right side, and it worked. And it was the knuckle curve that got him.
And so, he's the only guy who got Josh Smith out.
Yes. So this is all a testament to the work that this organization has done with Brendan Little. I don't think it's going anywhere, Blake. I think this is just who he is now.
Yeah, it's great. You have, I mentioned it on Blue Jay Central the other day when talking about Nathan Eovaldi, that there are only six pitchers in baseball who have a swing and miss rate of 37% on higher on multiple pitches, and Brendan Little is one of them. And so even if you only have two pitches, if guys are swinging and missing 40% of the time at one of them and like 50% of the time at the other one, you're in pretty good shape, because good luck. Okay, 50-50, you want to guess one versus the other? you can't hit it anyway. It's been pretty good to see. And then Jeff Hoffman closes it out, looking pretty good. Weak fly ball from Wyatt Langford. K's Corey Seager looking, and then gets Josh Young to pop up in the infield. He threw almost nothing in the strike zone. Guys were just kind of chasing and reaching. So nice to see back-to-back better performances for Jeff Hoffman.
Are you ready to say that he is all the way back, or no, would you like to see it a few more times?
Yeah, I would like to see it a few more times. Like, it was, you know, and see a little bit of the swing and miss back. This was, like, those are three pretty bad at-bats.
Yes.
There's a lot of swinging at stuff you shouldn't be swinging at.
Yeah.
Especially, like, if you come into that one knowing Jeff Hoffman has struggled of late.
And struggled exactly with that, with walking batters and with,
like, only four
pitches
of the 14 pitches he threw were in the zone.
Yeah, that's...
And
that's
like
not a winning recipe necessarily.
Yeah,
or
like
saving
recipe. You can get away with that. Like if I said that about Braden Fisher, who threw like 13 of the 20 pitches he threw were sliders, you're not locating those a ton in the zone. He's a guy who wants to get chase. He's not as established to challenge guys in the zone. But every time I talk to Jeff Hoffman, he wants all those pitches in the zone. He thinks his stuff's good enough to beat guys. So
He's right about that.
Yes. It's also good enough, apparently, to get guys to just flail at it out of the zone. Okay, one note before we take a break and talk to Jake Mintz of Cespedes Family Barbecue and Yahoo Sports. We also got John Morosi and Jessica Kleinschmidt coming on in the second half to whip around MLB and set up this athletic series. But we found out yesterday that the Jays are going to tweak their rotation a little bit this weekend. So the probables are Jose Berríos, Chris Bassitt, TBD, and Kevin Gausman. Normally, that would be Berríos, Bassitt, Gausman, Francis.
Yep.
But they are going to bump Gausman from Saturday to Sunday to buy him an extra day of rest. That will give Bowden Francis an entire week off before he starts on Tuesday. And then Saturday is the TBD day. So they have an off day Monday. So yes, you're going to have to cobble together a bullpen day on Saturday or a spot start. Maybe someone comes up. Maybe it's Eric Lauer or Paxton Schultz again. But the idea here being Kevin Gausman, I laid out what the rotation should look like for the next week or so. Kevin Gausman should get an extra day twice in a row. Mm-hmm. Chris Bassitt and Jose Berríos will get an extra day once each. And then Bowden Francis will get a double extra day. Maybe that has an effect on his pitching. Maybe it's primarily to separate the Bowden Francis day from the fifth starter day. It'll be interesting to see how they handle it Saturday. It might depend how these next two games go. But I think that's smart. I think the priority from Monday's off day, yeah, you want to get guys extra rest. But the biggest priority to me was you had to separate the Bowden Francis day from the fifth starter day for the sake of managing your bullpen.
Oh, 100%. This bullpen is going to be taxed as long as Bowden Francis is limited to two times through the order, and there's a bullpen day that follows him. So this was very much necessary. Saturday will be an interesting one. I have no idea how they're going to. I imagine Jose Urania is going to be part of that. Probably we'll see some Eric Lauer as well. He would be, you know, relatively fresh.
Yeah, he threw 41 pitches last night. And Paxton Schultz was in the 40s as well. So conceivably, all of these guys could be ready for Saturday if you don't need to use them today and tomorrow for any length. Yariel Rodriguez is also a guy you could get multiple innings from. So as far as you just had a Bowden Francis five inning start and a bullpen day back to back, you probably feel pretty good about how you're heading into this weekend, all things considered.
And it had to be the priority.
And then coming out of the weekend, you are much better suited to handle the ebbs and flows of a five game or a 5 day rotation period with Bowden Francis not next to SP5, whoever that is. We will see. By the way, Max Scherzer is expected to face live hitters in Toronto today or tomorrow. He would probably do that a couple times before going out on a rehab assignment. Andrés Giménez started a rehab assignment yesterday with single A Dunedin as he starts to work his way back. Eric Swanson is going to make one more appearance with Buffalo today. And then they have a doubleheader, weather permitting. And then he would likely be up at some point on the weekend. Ryan Burr suffered a setback, some right shoulder soreness. He's in Toronto to be looked at. We don't have an update yet. I assume we'll get one pregame. And then Spencer Turnbull threw another rehab start on Tuesday at A-ball. He is going to get bumped to AAA now. So another fifth starter potentially in the mix there. Adam Klopfenstein has worked his way back up to AAA as well. He's not on the 40-man, but and Spencer Turnbull's a guy they will have to add based on the specifics of that contract. So there are options moving forward, both in terms of relief help if you need to option down Paxton Schultz to get a little extra length on the weekend or something like that, and Eric Swanson returns, or if you want to. Saturday feels rushed for Spencer Turnbull since he hasn't started above A-ball, but length is coming, just not not imminently and not Max Scherzer level just yet. Let's take a break. Let's take a look around the world of baseball, including Progressive Field in Cleveland being covered in midges. It's Jake Mintz when we come back on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Jays will get it started for the first of four against the Athletics tonight at 7 o'clock down at Rogers Center. Jose Berríos against Jacob Lopez. And yes, Jacob Lopez throws with his left hand, which is something the Blue Jays have not seen in over 3 weeks. It's a weird stretch of righties only. Weird, but not unexpected, was the scene at Progressive Field this week where our next guest was covered in midges. It's Jake Mintz of Yahoo Sports of the Barbie Cast. Jake, what's up, man? First of all, great hair day. Second, how was your trip to Cleveland? Oh, Jake is muted. I don't know if that is on Jake's end or our end.
Whoop.
There you go. We nice. Got you, Jake.
You got me?
Yes.
You got me? You hear my dulcet tones?
Yes.
I'm doing wonderfully. I am in Cleveland, Ohio, visiting my good friend and better half of my baseball content making life, Jordan Schusterman, who lives here in Ohio. And I had not been to Cleveland in 6 years. And of course, the day that I show up, a hailstorm of midges descends on Progressive Field.
That must have been like a scene from the old town. I can't even imagine, honestly, Jake, what it would even look like. But apocalyptic is the word that comes to mind here.
It's like they're everywhere. And when it gets dark, it's even worse because like they congregate towards the light. So like if you're going in or out of a place of business, that is usually like lit up on the inside. And so when you open the door, following behind you are just thousands of midges. Now these babies, they live for 24 hours, right? And so they got a pretty good 24 hours. Imagine being alive for 24 hours, and in that span, you get to see Shohei Ohtani go
young. Yeah, it's every player is a once in a lifetime player when your lifespan is only 24 hours. But yeah, you get Shohei, and yeah, for God's sake, Lemon, we'd all like to flee to the Cleve, but you actually got to do it. Okay, midges aside, you just got a good look at the Dodgers for a couple of days. I know you had written about Shohei Ohtani's path back and him facing live hitters the other day, but the Dodgers dropped one last night, and you guys talked about on the last episode of the podcast. The Dodgers have maybe lost their claim here as the best team in baseball. How are you feeling about where the Dodgers are right now, having seen them up close a couple games in a row?
So I think what's important to understand about the Dodgers is that they're kind of treating the regular season like spring training. To an extent.
Must be nice.
And that it seems sick, dude. And that reality clouds everything that they do. And so you have to evaluate them through that lens, right? I think the Dodgers would have believed at this point they would have been further up than they are right now. And now that's because they have suffered just a comical amount of pitching injuries. They currently have 14 hurlers on their big league IL. That is seven starters and seven relievers. They only have three pitchers in their rotation that were with the team on opening day. And it's just very difficult to overcome that. The Dodgers can overcome a lot. That's what money does. That's what being elite at developing players can do. But they have, and I'm not asking anyone to feel bad for the Dodgers, right? Like, they go out and acquire pitchers who have a little bit higher of an injury risk. That is a strategy. Now, they're suffering the downside of that strategy right now. It kind of has to change your evaluation of this team, not necessarily in October, but over this next month, they're currently in the middle of a stretch where they have 26 games against teams with records above 500. 26 straight. That includes, I believe, seven against the Mets, three against the Yankees, seven against the Padres, three against the Giants, three against the Guardians, three against the Cardinals. How they do in this 26-game stretch is really just going to dictate what they do at the trade deadline. How many playoff starters do they need to acquire? One, two, zero, right? How big is their gap in the division at the end of the stretch? That will then dictate how they get to behave over the second half of the season. Look, they'll be in October, and we'll just have to evaluate them with the roster they enter October with.
Yeah, and listen, you spoke about the problems with injuries and pitchers, and there is only, I guess, so much that they can do with the current roster. One thing that is extremely encouraging is the fact that Shohei Ohtani is back facing live hitters and looking good doing it, right? And not only looking good, looking like he's having fun as well. A little bit tricky, of course, because you can't be without him for a period of time. He can't go out and rehab and things along those lines. But yeah, I guess how encouraging is it that Ohtani is coming back, and how will they utilize him at this point?
I have no idea. It's certainly encouraging. It's been a long time since he got surgery, right? It's one of those dates now that is seared in my mind as I've written about it time after time after time. September 19th, 2023 is when he got surgery. His last start was, I believe, August 23rd of 2023. I mean, it's been a minute, right? Think about all the things that have happened in all of our lives since August of 2023. You know, and Ohtani, the pitcher, is still a couple of months from being back on a mound. I'd be shocked if it happens before the All-Star break, right? Now, what's interesting as he makes his way back into games is they're obviously going to utilize him as a starter, but they aren't going to have him throw four, five, six innings every start. And does he have the bandwidth to go out and throw six innings worth of baseball at 2 o'clock before a 7 o'clock game where he's going to hit that night? So Ohtani, the two-way player, presents all these very unique challenges from a health, fitness, workload tracking perspective that we've never seen before. Because when he came back from the first surgery with the Angels, one, the tech was worse. Two, the Angels were like, you go get him, big guy. Like, whatever you want to do, Shohei, you let it ride. Now, the Dodgers have made him the centerpiece of this entire business juggernaut, and they can't afford to do that. When he is a top three position player in the world as a DH, is it worth the risk pushing him back onto the mound? I would be shocked if he starts a playoff game on the mound, to be honest with you.
And at least they have the, you know, the Shohei rule now where he could stay in as a hitter and things that. But the idea of the rehab aspect that you just laid out is so fascinating where, you know, is he an opener? Is he basically doing the Ben Kasparius role because that's all you're going to use him for? And then you have a follower ready to go. It's fascinating. Jake, correct me if I'm wrong. You've had Tommy John surgery, right?
I have had Tommy John surgery. Yeah, right here. Nice. For anybody watching at home.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there you go. That was when you were in college?
It's a much sadder, less cool story than that. That makes me look even more like a dork. I pitched in college and was a reliever and threw a ton. I graduated that summer, kept pitching in men's leagues, and stopped doing any working out or stretching of my elbow. Turns out that's bad for you. And so I blew out in 2017. Didn't get surgery until like 2.5 years after that.
Okay.
Because it was like, I'm not playing anymore. But then it started to hurt to like do a push-up or like dry my hair with a towel because it's the same motion as like throwing. And so I just wanted to be able to play catch with my kids one day. And so I got surgery and didn't come back for anything necessarily.
Ah, that's interesting. I am dealing with a bad elbow issue right now. Now, I didn't throw heat out of the bullpen for Washington in college.
Neither did I.
Yeah. I mean, your numbers are pretty good, though. I looked them up. They're pretty good. Anyway, you also, no offense, weren't hitting, you know, weren't on pace for 50 home runs and 30 stolen bases as you were recovering. So I was going to ask you about the recovery process from the pitcher side, but if you weren't throwing, then I don't know. Fun story for everyone to hear you had your elbow chopped up, though.
I can speak to that. I mean, that's what's remarkable about what Ohtani is doing, is if you ask any pitcher about the rehab process from Tommy John, it's grueling. Most of these pitchers come back in the best shape of their lives because you have to get your elbow back to where it needs to be. Now, that's why Ohtani's return has taken so much longer than the average one, is because he is hitting, leading off, jacking home runs, and stealing bases all at the same time. And so it is understandable that the Dodgers would take care to make sure he's healthy before they push him back into a game. I was there in Queens when he threw against live hitters. That was on Sunday. And it was cool, dude. It was just a reminder that, like, what a special thing that we get to witness. I understand that Jays fans maybe don't love Shohei Ohtani after the way things went down. But it is a gift that we get to see this. I understand that he gets a lot of eyeballs and clicks and attention. But enjoy it while it's here. because it won't be around forever.
Yeah, I mean, if Jays fans hated every player who was alleged to have almost signed here and then didn't, it would be hard to watch out of market baseball.
Yeah, they would hate a lot of Dodgers, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, some Mets, it'd be tough to watch some out of market stuff. Okay, so the other side of this series, I know the Shohei thing was in Queens, but you've been in Cleveland this week, and things are going all right for the Guardians. Jose Ramirez on a nice little streak. Emmanuel Clase has, I believe, only allowed 2 runs over his last like 12 or 13 outings. So things looking a little more stable in the back end there. What do you make of the Guardians and really that kind of trio of AL Central teams that like the Tigers are here and then those three teams are all kind of okay?
Yeah, they're okay. They should merge. They should just join forces, you know, be the Kansas City Twin Guardians or something. Like,
sure.
Because none of them, in my opinion, can win a World Series. Now, I know that's not necessarily the defining factor of a successful season. Like, the Guardians got to the ALCS last year, and that was a good season. But I just don't think they have enough needle-moving players behind Jose Ramirez. I mean, what a player he is. Oh, my gosh. We were talking, this is a good little story about Ramirez. We were talking to a Guardians hitter last night after the game about kind of preparing for pitchers and what kind of at-bats do you watch to prepare. And this guy goes, yeah, so when I go through the way a pitcher is attacking our guys, I skip Ramirez because he's being attacked in a way that none of the other hitters in the lineup are, which says something about him and the other hitters in the lineup, right? And I think that is the eternal problem with Cleveland, is that they are an organization that is good at finding value and making the most of what they have. I just don't know if they have enough.
Yeah, and we definitely saw that, say, with the Andrés Giménez trade, right? So that's a guy that's making a lot of money. Well, they shipped him to Toronto, and they're going to try to build in other ways, not trying, obviously, to replace his defense. And Stephen Vogt was pretty open about that when he was here, and they were seeing Giménez for the first time in a Blue Jays uniform. But that is kind of the MO, and you're right, Jake, that, you know, that more often than not will not translate into, you know, deep postseason runs and things along those lines.
I've already started the clock on Stephen Kwan getting traded to the Blue Jays in like 2028 when he gets expensive.
So I think he's a guy they want to extend.
Yeah.
I mean, they extended Giménez too, though, and then like backloaded it. And once the freight came, then he was available in trade.
That is true. I think that the ceiling on Kwan is higher. Mm-hmm. I think Kwan is a different level of player than Giménez. And their issue is not can they find outs on defense. It is can they score runs on offense. And I think just that is the key difference between Kwan and Giménez, as I'm sure you have seen in Toronto in regard to Giménez and his offensive tribulations.
And Kwan, when they were here, had the most, I mean, Stephen Kwan, this is what Stephen Kwan does, but he had the most annoying series imaginable if you're a Blue Jay fan.
Every time. But still, that division is tough because of the Detroit Tigers, right? And that has been one of the best stories in the major leagues, in my mind. Tarik Skubal throwing his shutout, his Maddux last time out. What more can we say about this guy? Is this another Cy Young season? Can he one-up himself here?
He's better. Like, what? He threw 102.6 on the last pitch of the game. That is freakish. And watching Skubal carve up the Guardians on Sunday, for me, was just a reminder of what starting pitching as an experience, as an entertainment product, can and should be. Now, I'm not saying that every starting pitcher should go out there and throw a complete game shutout Maddux with, you know, 15 strikeouts or whatever. Like, but the experience of watching someone carve up a lineup like that, right, and understand that they're part of a show, that people are going to the yard to see something, to experience something, to be entertained, Skubal understands that. And it makes it so much fun to watch. It's so compelling. The Tigers are a fascinating team. They mix and match. I believe they played the Blue Jays like last weekend, right?
Yeah.
Like, they mix and match so much. And they have a really impressive amount of institutional buy-in for that strategy from the players. It's like, hey, we believe in you. Sixth inning, if you're a right-handed hitter, they bring in a righty reliever, we are almost certainly going to go get a lefty bat off the bench.
Yeah, and that's okay.
Yeah,
right?
It's fascinating. And then you look at the reliever roles and things like that too, like Tyler Holton, kind of the main guy, but Tommy Canley and Bo Brisky are shifting around role. Will Vest is closing games sometimes, an opener sometimes. It takes a lot. The Scooble things, here's maybe the best way to highlight the gap between the Tigers and those okay teams in the Central. He just did that to the Guardians. He faces the Royals on Saturday, who are even worse offensively than the Guardians. Now, obviously, those teams have better records than the Blue Jays, and the Blue Jays have struggled to score runs as well. But it is, these are playoff teams in the same division that he's mowing through, and I would expect him to mow again on Saturday. Jake, also this weekend, a thing we'll be keeping an eye on, and I know it's something you really enjoy, is the NCAA baseball tournament. It gets going with regionals on Friday, super regionals next weekend, and it extends through June 23rd. At a high level, how excited are you for the tournament this year, and kind of what is kind of the key story you're keeping an eye on as we get going here?
So I'll shoot straight with you. This is the most checked out I've been on the college side in 6 or 7 years, just because my job has taken up more of my time and I'm moving this summer. That being said, I will be watching on Friday. And I think that's what I would communicate to people, is you don't need to have been following the season to enjoy the college postseason because of the chaos. College baseball is worse than professional baseball from a skill perspective. That lends itself to a wider array of outcomes on the field and makes more things possible, right? And that can be a ground ball to the left side that looks like a routine play, might be an error, right? Or if a team is up 7 in the eighth, that game's not over, right? And so it means you have to keep watching, like, all the time in a way that you don't, right? If, like, you're watching a Blue Jays game and there's a grounder to third, like, you can just look at your phone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But these guys, because they're worse, it's almost more interesting. But they're still throwing 97. They're still hitting the ball 112. And so I find that to be awesome. And then there's the component of it that, like, why do we love March Madness? Is, like, it means something to these people who are never going to play in the big leagues, right? It carries this emotional heft that makes people cry on the field. And as fans, that's what we want to see. We want to see people that care, that are living and dying with this. And that is what the college baseball tournament really provides. I highly recommend, if possible, like, watch the multi-screen, because then you're just, like, you're bombarded. Sit on the couch for an hour and just take it in at, like, 2 o'clock Eastern is, like, the first wave of games is ending and the second wave is starting. There's a lot to watch. I would say just a couple names from the top of the draft. Liam Doyle is a left-handed starter at the University of Tennessee who throws comically hard. He's going to be a top 10 pick. Ava Arquette is a very impressive bat at Oregon State University that I'd recommend. I think the top of the draft this year, it's like a little flatter than usual, where there's no, like, Paul Skeens type, but there's still a lot of talented players that I think fans should tune in for.
That was quite the endorsement. I'm very excited now, Jake. And I have to say, just a side note here, kudos to you for moving in the middle of the baseball season. That is a tall task right there.
I haven't done it yet. I'm moving in August.
Well, thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I lived in the same apartment for 5 years, moving cities. So it'll be quite an undertaking.
I assume you're moving to Cleveland. You just liked it so much in your couple of days that you're like, I got to make this permanent.
I need these midges in my life always. Okay. I fell in love.
Yeah. It's got to be tough, especially with hair as long and luscious as yours. There's probably still some in there. I wouldn't run into that quite. Julia, you'd run into that lot too with your curls.
I would run into that problem, yes.
Short, straight hair. I'm fine.
Don't talk about my hair. Your co-host is, I mean... Good job, Julia.
Yeah, that's great. Jake, thanks so much.
Let's share tips.
Thank you.
Yes, you guys do that. Jake, thanks, man. This is great. Really appreciate it. Tell Jordan we said hi as well.
Will do. Thank you for having me.
Jake Mintz, Yahoo Sports, Suspetta's Family Barbecue as well. You can check out the Barbacast over at Yahoo Sports. A lot of good stuff a couple times a week there. And yeah, NCAA tournament gets going tomorrow. Obviously, on this show, we won't do a ton of NCAA tournament stuff. I'd imagine we're closer to the draft. We will, as we usually do, have some of those draft people on who are following that tournament more closely, highlight some of the Canadian names as we get to the Super Regionals and things like that. Last year, we even had Emilian Petrie on the show after he was drafted. He was a Kentucky standout heading into the tournament. Then we had him on the show after he was drafted. Always fun to take a look at all of that, but especially hunt through for the Canadian names of relevance. Speaking of which, Sam Shaw, who is a Canadian in the Blue Jay system, is like the hottest hitter in the system right now at Single A Dunedin. I would imagine he's going to join the rest of our guys in Vancouver at some point soon.
Should be soon.
Gotta highlight the CanCon. Speaking of CanCon, the Athletics recently called up Denzel Clark, who, as our next guest said, makes every catch look easy. We'll take a break. We'll get to know this Athletics team a little bit more with Jessica Kleinschmidt. John Morosi will join us in the second hour of the show as well. All that's to come. We'll get you set up for Jacob Lopez against Jose Berríos too, as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Jays take 2 of 3 against the Rangers, despite scoring only 4 runs. Let's hope they score more than 4 over these next 4 against the Athletics, who come in an interesting spot. Got off to a pretty fun start to the season, but things have not gone all that well of late. They're also playing in a new ballpark, in a new city. Let's find out all about it with Jessica Kleinschmidt. She's part of the Athletics broadcast team. She joins us now. Jessica, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. I like that you use the term interesting, because that's the perfect definition right now.
Yeah, it's, and that can, you know, eye of the beholder, read into that what you want. I'm curious, before the interestingness of the team, how has the season been for you with this new ballpark and new environment and new city?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm lucky enough where I called a few AAA games in the PCL, so I'm somewhat used to it. However, I'm not used to seeing two major league teams going at it at this ballpark. So it's a little bit different as far as that goes when we're used to the Coliseum, but it's just more like kind of cramped and adjusting to those aspects. But the players seem comfortable. The amenities are all there. There, of course, are going to be some adjustments, whether we were moving anywhere else, true. And so I think from that perspective, we're kind of getting in a rhythm there, and we haven't really identified how the ball plays. The ball has been flying a little bit, but there aren't a lot of games that we can say 100% how, if it's going to be 100% a hitter's ballpark, if the pitchers are happy with it, and obviously gets hot. But as time goes on, perhaps it'll identify itself, but it's all about adjustment.
Yeah, it's a game of adjustments. This is just kind of a different type of adjustment. And Jessica, let me just say thank you so much for joining. It's nice to meet you finally. I feel like
I'm such a Julia fan. She saved me so many times on air because I didn't know who was calling or interviewing the skipper, and she asked the most beautiful questions, and it helped us. So I just want to say thank you for that.
Oh, my goodness. This is great. This is a show for me to get shy, so I appreciate her
hair got complimented in the last segment, and she got very exactly like this. About it. So,
all right, let's get back to talking about
the A's. Talk about Jessica. Are you down to just talk about Julia for like 20 minutes?
No, the A's are more interesting, I will say, for 20 minutes. And listen, great start to the season here, Jessica. Obviously, they've cooled off since then. A ton of ups and downs, which I guess is kind of expected when you think about a young group, new location, all of that. But what is the energy like right now? What's the mindset like right now in that clubhouse?
You know, it's interesting because to lose 13 of 15 is, you know, ups and downs is one thing, but that's just tough. And, you know, you see these guys over the last few seasons, and there's veterans, and of course, there's younger guys. In the weird way, I think it's kind of cool to watch, to have the younger guys see what it's like to lose in a major league season. These things happen. You always want to be even keeled. But I mean, obviously, the energy isn't 100% where they would like it to be. I mean, losing sucks, and that's just kind of the actuality of it. And I think from that perspective, as time goes on, hopefully there's a catapult into it. But it's been a tough few seasons, or a tough few series going on, honestly, a tough few seasons as well. But these National League teams that the team's gone up against have been tough, but you can't really always do the strength of schedule. So I'm hoping, you know, the veterans are providing some information and just some pep talks. And of course, we have Luis Severino in there and Jeffrey Springs and a lot of guys who are used to seeing some of these ups and downs, both individually and as a team. So it's just interesting because these younger guys don't really know what it's like to have all of these losses. is, and the front office is shaking some things up. But I think we can all agree it could be a little bit more positive in there.
Yeah, a few little roster tweaks of late. Osvaldo Beto goes down. We get Denzel Clark up, who is from around here, you know, Toronto and Thornhill. So this will be a special weekend for him, I'd imagine. So actually, I guess, yeah, let me just ask about him. You tweeted the other day that he makes every catch look easy. Have you gotten a chance to chat with him, get to know him a little bit yet? Obviously, you know, there'll be a lot of eyes hoping he does well long term, just maybe not this weekend here in Toronto.
Yeah, so for Baseball America, I was able to pick his brain during the spring breakout in March. And not only did I find out how athletic he was, but we're both big Joey Votto fans. So that was great to start out there. But for him, he's the defense. I don't think I've ever seen a more defensively athletic player in my life. He's just so sound. He can cover so much range. And the reason why I mentioned that catch aspect is there's some catches that were about 15 to 20% likely to be caught, and he made it look so easy. Offensively, it's going to be interesting to see how he fares. And I talked to David Forrest, the A's GM, about that before Denzel was brought up. And he just needed some exposure as far as at-bats goes. But, you know, JJ Bleday was struggling in center field on both sides of the ball. So it was kind of the perfect time to flip-flop those guys. But, I mean, overall, the guy's got an 80-grade personality. And as athletic as he is, he's the least athletic person in his family. His mom has a lucrative athletic career, and so does his sister. The entirety of his family is part of the Naylor family. Those are his cousins. And he actually didn't even get started until he was 15. So he's a bit of a late bloomer as far as playing baseball goes. So if you ever would just want to watch a defensively sound guy, just watch him. But like I said, hopefully he evens that out with some offensive production.
I did not know he was part of that family. I didn't know that they were cousins. That's I guess that makes sense. I mean, that's kind of what we do around here.
Yeah, the first family of Canadian baseball, I guess, is the way it works out.
Yeah, a tradition begins. But one of the good stories there, and another guy that's been fascinating to watch, especially at the plate, is Jacob Wilson, right? He is, first of all, just the stance, the mechanics, so twitchy, so bizarre. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that before. And then he makes contact with everything, Jessica. Just how rare is that, and how cool has it been to watch a guy like that playing like he's playing video games, I guess?
Yeah, I feel like I'm watching history, and a lot of people are comparing those numbers, obviously, to Tony Gwynn and Jim Thome. And I think watching him, and now that we're finally embracing average, I think it's the perfect time to put him, or re-embracing average, perfect time to put him on that platform. But it's been great, and the power is finally catching up as well. And I think no matter where you're throwing it in the quadrant, for him to take advantage of it has been great. Even the change-ups, because he's got a very slow bat swing. Him and Luis Arraez are known for that. But to just watch him go out there has been awesome. We don't even talk about his defensive capabilities. And of course, the bloodline is there because of his father. And so the baseball IQ is insane as well. And to see all the range that he covers. And also when Jack's there, he's just a dad. It's really cool to just watch him embrace it, be on the other side. He's not coaching. He's not doing anything of that aspect. And the cool part of that was he actually just kind of helped him as far as becoming a major league player, the mindset that's involved. I know the mechanics are certainly important, but kind of introducing him to the lifestyle was a big proponent to why he's so successful. But you would not think this is only his second season, the way that he approaches it, and he can play anywhere in the lineup. We mentioned the average, and we haven't even talked about the fact that he's pretty stellar on bases as well. So when it comes to the average and seeing him being able to make contact with everything, it's so much fun to watch.
Yeah, only a 5% strikeout rate. The dugout celebrating when he got his first walk after that.
I know, it was beautiful. It was
like 100-plus plate appearances, that one. And it's amazing. So funny because, like, obviously, like, as kids, we, like, replicate batting stances and stuff like that. And, like, his is – it's going to be impossible. Like, the double toe tap, the kind of clockwork, the metronome of the bat and everything like that, it's – there's too much going on to replicate it. I think it's a lot of fun. Another guy who's a lot of fun, and I'm pretty fascinated by it, and I'm curious how much you've gotten to chat baseball with him. Brent Rooker has – for my money, the best Twitter account of any active baseball player, really pulls the curtain back in terms of hitter process. This is what it's like to face this pitcher. You know, just kind of letting the average fan know what's actually going on through a player's head, why it is so difficult to hit. So I'm curious if you've gotten to chat with him about that kind of stuff, and him being, you know, not an old guy, but a vet for the purposes of this team, where he fits into that dynamic that you were mentioning of guys who have been through this a little bit before, obviously went through the tough season there in 2023.
Yeah, and for Brent, he's had every aspect too. He's had to prove it himself. He's had to come off the bench. He's been the guy that nobody really believed in and the guy that was constantly being, you know, let go. And I think from that perspective, you mentioned the veteran presence. It's interesting because he doesn't have that many years of service time, but he certainly has a lot of exposure to the game. And yeah, I think who he is off the field too. I did ask him, I was like, do you think you're funnier in person or on Twitter? And he said Twitter, which might be, we'll have some talks about that. He's definitely, you know, I appreciate somebody who doesn't let the fans just kind of walk all over them and be able to talk to however they want to. He said, you know, sometimes they deserve a response. He does put his Twitter away in the off season to not be distracted, but it's just really cool because he's such a student of the game still as well. And while he's still providing the leadership to some of these younger guys, and he loves that role, he's still able to get better. And we saw that he was a silver slugger last season, but prior he was the all-star select, and that was before the average was coming out. He's now improved as far as the two-strike approach and playing chess back and forth with those pitchers. So he's just all around the perfect guy. And that's why they gave them the extension, is because of how great he is on and off the field. A great guy in the community, a great father, a great husband. And I think having a guy like that kind of be the pillar of it all, and you have Lawrence Butler behind him and all these younger guys being able to learn from him, and even other veterans as well. They want to hit like Brent Rooker. Why not? And we didn't even talk about the fact he stole like 11 bases last year, because why not? Every other number was great. Why not add to it? I think he was the biggest all-star snub in 2024. And I will say that every time somebody mentions Brent Rooker, but he's just been such a great guy to not only watch, but learn from as well.
Yeah. The personality aspect is so huge, right? Especially when you're talking about a young team going through a bit of a rough patch. So important to have those guys. I think of George Springer a little bit here in Toronto for those purposes and for those moments. But you also mentioned Lawrence Butler. Great season last year. I think he had a 9-game hit streak just snapped last night. Maybe the numbers aren't exactly where they were last year, but what are you seeing from him right now?
Yeah, he made a great adjustment last season. He had to go to AAA and figure some things out. A small little minor tweak with his head adjustment that him and hitting coach Darren Bush worked on. And the next thing you know, Lawrence Butler was that guy. The guy that they drafted, the guy that they saw from the very beginning. And you want to talk about a clubhouse guy, they just flocked to him. You know, when you know how a clubhouse looks. You look over and there's 5 chairs around Lawrence Butler's locker. They just want to hang out with him. And sometimes they're talking baseball. Sometimes they're talking everything but baseball. And you need that vibe in the clubhouse. And you mentioned those numbers. Yeah, I think from this time on, he just kind of had to settle in a little bit. And they were moving him up and down the lineup, seeing maybe perhaps that's a certain tweak as well. But starting, you know, being the leadoff guy, I've talked to him about it. He goes, I love not only setting the tone, but I do like to pounce on the pitcher first thing as well. And we know how those leadoff guys like to do that. Very athletic. And like I said, I know he's learning, but he's still the guy that people are learning from. And just a guy that everybody wants to be around. And I think from the defensive capabilities, I don't think we've seen partially of what he's able to do. I think as time goes on, we'll have a better, you know, viewpoint of that. But he's been awesome to watch as well. I know kids are obsessed with him, and he walks up to kids like they're just like his teammates. And I think that those kids appreciate that as well. So you want to talk about not only a good guy on the field, but off the field as well, just like Rooker.
And another guy that they locked up long-term for those reasons and the on-field reasons under club control now through 2032, which feels an impossible length away, even right after the Vlad contract.
So, the blink of an eye.
So when we look at this Athletics team, and it's even with the losing streak, they've been one of the most fun teams to watch out of market games for. We haven't seen them against the Blue Jays yet, but they have all these young, fun guys. And then there's one guy who hasn't been around in Zach Gelof, who has started a hitting progression now. That's another 25-year-old in the middle infield who they're going to add back eventually. I know we're probably a couple of weeks, maybe even a month or more away from that just yet. But when they get him back, is that kind of, we have an idea now of what this is supposed to look like for the near future?
Yeah, and I think that that's kind of great. The front office, we're kind of looking at them like they were mad scientists. We weren't sure how things were going to look. But then after these, you know, drafts and these moves, these trades, you're kind of getting a good overview. And we haven't even mentioned Nick Kurtz right now, right? That guy's, he's on the 10-day IL, and his power is finally coming up there. I'm a little curious just what's going to happen this season, because Luis Urias has been absolutely fantastic at second base. So that aspect is going to be interesting. But for Gelof to come back, I don't know what he's going to look like. I haven't seen him since the spring. And of course, it was an injury on top of an injury. So that's going to be interesting. But these younger guys, it's taking shape. And I think a third base situation, that's been a hole since Matt Chapman's left. And I think since, I don't know if they're going to have another veteran presence to kind of be there, but Miguel Andujar has been pretty fantastic. But maybe in the future, we have this young core that maybe is playing well above their maturation level, which has been so much fun to watch. But to have maybe Soderstrom and Kurtz kind of back and forth at first, Geloff at second, of course, Jacob Wilson at shortstop, and maybe a couple of platoon guys at third base, to see these young guys really go in action and being smart has been wonderful.
Speaking of, you mentioned Matt Chapman there. The one piece of the return for Matt Chapman is now starting for the Athletics, and Gunnar Hoglund, you know, was notable here, but was still too early on for Jays fans to really, you know, any kind of attachment there. But cool to see the key piece in the Matt Chapman trade now up in the majors. What have you seen from him in these first handful of starts? We're going to see him on Saturday, I think, here.
Yeah. He's got some fearlessness, especially for a younger guy, and a lot of command for a younger guy. And I talked to his agent recently, and you want to talk about a guy who's coming off of, you know, two seasons of rehab after Tommy John. And I picked his brain a little bit about some of these, you know, secondary pitches, and he's not scared to throw them. His changeup is gnarly. And to see that he's going to be able to end some of these swing and misses with that pitch has been great. He just kind of sticks to his own thing, and having him be brought up after JT Gibbs went down with an injury, you never know what you're going to get with some of these younger guys after they get promoted. And for him to flawlessly enter that rotation has been great. You mentioned the trade, because the ROI, you're never really sure what you're going to get, because Kirby Snead didn't quite pan out. And I think from that aspect, you know, we can't compare Matt Chapman to anybody really, as far as especially a pitcher, but to know that after a couple of years, these things happen. And of course you have to go through the Tommy John phase in order to be a major league pitcher, but in order for him to be put on that major league stage, and he's been absolutely fantastic. He's been really fun to watch.
Yeah. I know we're not going to see the next pitcher that I want to talk about. We spoke about injuries and things of the sort. And Luis Severino just got his 1,000th career strikeout. And I have to say, it was pretty heartbreaking, Jessica, to sort of read his quotes from postgame, in which he's saying, yeah, I wish it had happened sooner. And he mentions the injuries, obviously a momentous occasion, but, you know, hard to take it just as a good thing when the guy sort of has a bittersweet feeling about it.
Yeah, and you want to talk about a veteran guy, and I like obviously what he can do in those numbers, but he's been a veteran presence in the clubhouse as well. These guys have no idea how major league players win, like live. He brought in a ping pong table. I think there was an agenda there, because he's just really damn good at ping pong. And he's just like, he just womps all over these guys. But you mentioned that, and I think it was cool to just read the quotes about him saying, I wish I would have done this differently earlier in my career. And that alone is teaching some of these younger guys. And you know, he's just one of those things where earlier on in your career, you think you know everything, right? I'm still going through that phase. And it's just one of those things where having him be able to set the precedent of that as well. He also recently, Julia, said, I wish that Cy Young numbers were based on just the splits, because his road games are insane. He said, I'd be the freaking Cy Young Award winner if that were the case. So the splits for him are great, but I think it's cool. Like, he knows what he's learned from. He knows what happened and why some of these injuries possibly occurred. And you're right. I think we've all would want some of our accolades to happen earlier rather than later. But you want to talk about a guy that I've learned a lot from, it's been him as well. And like I said, he brings the veteran presence off the field stuff too, teaching the younger guys, this is how a veteran, it's how a major league ball player carries themselves. And you couldn't have a better guy to learn from than him.
We'll have to invent some sort of award. Like, there's the Rolaids Relief Award. We can get like a Road Warrior Award going. If you have a sub one ERA on the road this late into the season, we can come
it's
up with
insane. Those are video game numbers. Yeah. Like, oh my gosh.
And we have awards for everything else. Yeah, we just keep making up new ones. We can make this one up for Luis Severino. We'll give it to him in October on the show if no one else will.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll bring it up. Yeah, but youth is wasted on the young is kind of where I go with that, right? And I guess we all go through those moments of like, dang, I wish I'd known this when I was 22 or whatever. Jessica, this is a very fun team. Everything, you know, kind of points to that, talking to you. And one of the most fun moments of the season so far, at least from where I'm sitting, was Johnny Barreda striking out Shohei Ohtani, right? The catcher comes in to pitch. He keeps the ball. That's how important that was. I guess, what was the vibe around just that situation and the decision to not only keep but frame the ball?
Yeah, so Pareda's like the go-to position player to pitch, and he's pretty good overall, but I just appreciated he was very honest, because at first you thought it was a tongue-in-cheek kind of thing, but then you take a step back and like, of course you want to hold on to that baseball. And it was displayed. He was so happy about it. And even Mark Kotze said this is going to be the A's got their butts kicked, let's be honest, but it was one of those things where Kotze said this is going to be a day that Pareda will never forget. And you want to just talk about a great guy overall, you know, to be behind the dish with some of these younger guys has been fantastic. And I think, you know, that's just who he is. He's fun. He's a gamer. And to come over to the Athletics organization and really set the precedence for a backup catcher. He is down in AAA because those offensive numbers weren't quite great, but he'll be back later on in the season. I just think it was such a fun moment. And I would do the same thing. If Shohei Ohtani looked in my direction, I'd like keep the elbow pad or whatever I was using. So I just appreciated it. Like that's the baseball stuff that like, we're going to be able to talk about. It's not a baseball reference page, but what a fun story, and good for him to be, you know, honest enough to say, I'm going to keep this baseball. This was a really cool moment.
Yeah, absolutely. You keep it. I would do the same thing. We talked the other day about, I forget who it was that had all their credentials hanging in the background of their shot. We talked about how we all keep, like I just have mine in a big freezer bag that sits underneath my living room table. And that's, I didn't face Shohei Ohtani and strike him out for any of those. I was like, I'm going to go cover a G League basketball game. I'll keep my credential. Of course, I would keep the Shohei ball.
Whatever special to you is special to me, I always say.
Exactly. Nice. Jessica, thanks so much for doing this. Really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
Jessica Kleinschmidt, part of the Athletics broadcast. We'll see that team for four. Starting tonight, Jose Berríos against Jacob Lopez. Jacob Lopez, interesting one to figure out. Mm-hmm. Mostly just because it feels like the Blue Jays haven't faced a lefty in weeks, because they haven't faced a lefty in weeks. Fourth fewest plate appearances in Major League Baseball against left-handed pitching. Yusei Kikuchi on May 7th was the last time they faced a left-handed starter. And Jacob Lopez isn't a known commodity. Comes in with a 2.57 ERA. That sounds great. He's only pitched 14 innings, though. Three games as a reliever, and then he does a bulk opener, 2 2/3, Paxton Schultz style, and then out of nowhere last start, goes 7 against the Phillies of all teams and only allows one run, a solo home run. So a little hard to figure out. He had a 2.33 ERA at AAA earlier this year, and when he's gotten small major league opportunities, his ERA is 3.93. So you like some of that. Doesn't strike a ton of guys out, but also doesn't walk a ton of guys. Still just like kind of an unknown. And an interesting thing, especially as the summer goes on in the ballpark he plays in, is huge fly ball rates. He is not going to generate a lot of ground balls. We'll see what the Blue Jays do with that, because obviously we talked, you know, yesterday about their attack angles and things like that and the ability to, you know, damage in the air. This guy will give up a lot of contact in the air. So we'll see how that plays out. He's also another one of those guys that he's 6'4" with the big extension down the mound. So you look and you say, or you see 91 mile an hour on the fastball and guys aren't hitting it that well. Well, that's why.
It's because he's looks like it's coming from a lot closer than it actually is. And
yes,
if the roof was open, then, you know, maybe the fly ball rate would play a bit more of a factor. It's raining a lot, so I don't expect
the roof to be open. We also we can't. This is a thing with park factors that it comes up with the Athletics. It came up with Steinbrenner Field. We need such a huge sample as it is for ballpark factors. And this is like the Jays have tweaked their ballpark so many times. Obviously, the walls and the distances at one point. But as they change the sections, that changes the airflow. They change the foul ground territory, which changes, you know, some foul balls become, or some outs become foul balls and vice versa, depending on the part of the thing. So usually we need 3 years of ballpark factors before we can safely say Great this American is Ballpark is Great American Bandbox. We can say that. With Rogers Center, it has changed so many times, and then you have to split it into roof open, roof closed. We'll never know.
Yeah.
We'll never know. So far, the new stuff plays us slightly pitcher friendly, but it's very, very noisy. Maybe Jacob Lopez will give us a hint. Actually, Dalton Varsho and Bobichet both faced him in 2023.
Okay.
He started with Tampa Bay against the Blue Jays, and the Jays touched him up, but Dalton Varsho and Bobichet are the only guys left from that lineup.
Wow.
And that was only 2023.
And they were just fine, right?
Varsho was 1-for-3, and then Bichet was 0-for-3 with a strikeout. So that's a little bit about Jacob Lopez.
Yeah, and also 2023 was a long time ago. Different hitters, different pitcher. It's been a while, so tough to know exactly what to look for in this one.
Yeah, he'll go up against Jose Berríos, who has been all over the place. The overall number is not that bad. 4.22 ERA, decent strikeout rate, walking a few too many guys. And then all the under the hood stuff is like alarm bells going off. But that's happened with Barrios before. And because he's so smart and throws five pitches, like maybe there's an element of he's just like he does things Bassett style where the peripheral numbers are never going to catch up to what Jose Barrios is doing. But also, as Dan Schulman pointed out on the broadcast in his last start, he is among the league leaders in how often he has to pitch with runners on base.
Right.
And that is partially, you can get them for contact. The walk rate is up and things like that. So high stress for Jose Barrios. Last start was a better example. First inning, he gave up the three and then kind of cruised from there to give the Jays six. You'll want to see a little bit more of that. This time from Jose Barrios against an A's team that is not playing pretty well, but that's almost all on the run prevention side. They can hit and they can hit for power. They're eighth in the league in home runs, seventh in batting average, and seventh in isolated slugging. So there's some pop to this team. It's the issues are all on the pitching side. Bullpen still has an ERA over six this late into the season. So you hope you get the ball, get the bats going.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be a series or a game to build on. But again, we need to look at that first inning, which has been a trouble for Barrios and especially for the Blue Jays offense.
-28 run differential in the first inning as a team.
Yeah, on paper it looks great. It won't be great until the Blue Jays actually execute on both sides.
Or I could petition the league and see if we can play this game on paper. They don't generally do that. But if you play it on paper, the Jays might score more than four runs in this series. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll whip around Major League Baseball and MLB Network's rained out showcase game between the Phillies and the Braves. An awesome series. We get a doubleheader of it today instead. We'll talk to John Morosi of MLB Network about it as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. The Jays and Athletics will get underway at 7 o'clock at 6:45. If you turn on MLB Network, you will get the second half of a doubleheader between the Phillies and the Braves that was rained out last night. It was supposed to be MLB Network showcase game of the week. It still will be. It'll just take place today instead of yesterday. Speaking of MLB Network, we are now joined by John Morosi. John, good morning and congratulations to belated by a couple days, but the USA Hockey gold medal in the World Championships. I know you were locked in on the knockout stage there. Congratulations.
Blake and Julia, I appreciate it. Congratulations, most importantly, to Canada on the Four Nations triumph. So I think that means that there's one gold medal aside, and we'll see how things settle out in Milano Cortina just a few months from now. But yeah, that was a historic achievement there for the U.S., first time in 92 years that they had won it. And speaking of my co-favorite sport, I'm still in Philadelphia, of course, as you're mentioning, got the game tonight, and Rob Thompson tells me he is very eager to have his first conversation with Rick Tocchet now that Tock has become the head coach of the Flyers. So there's always a brief amount of baseball discussed for obvious reasons, but then Rob and I will typically discuss hockey and the times that he had playing against Mark Hunter when Rob was growing up there in the Sarnia area.
I love that, and I love how diplomatic you were, John. Sure. Immediately congratulating Canada as well. Well done.
Yeah.
Thank you, Julie. I appreciate it.
Mark Hunter, of course, longtime coach of the London Knights here as well, just across the border from you in Michigan. John, so you are still in Philly. That game got rained out. You guys bumped the network showcase game to today. I love a doubleheader myself. We don't get them all that often in Toronto because we've got a roof. And I think the ice, right. I think there's only been an ice storm damage the roof once that we've had a doubleheader at Rogers Center. How do you like a doubleheader and more like on the professional side, how does the network showcase game getting rained out and bumped? Like, is the rest of your kind of week and weekend in disarray a little bit here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So behind the scenes a little bit, I'm still covering this day as if I'm covering both games, if you will.
Okay.
So I'm here in the morning. We've got the Braves are on the field right now. The Phillies actually were there earlier too, going through their infield. I don't think either team's going to hit on the field. But for us, the all the conversations, the production meetings, if you will, chances to catch up with players. I visited with the former Blue Jay, Taiwan Walker. Got some good updates on how Jordan Romano has bounced back here with the Phillies. So this, it's almost like you just move your day up early. And then once game one starts, it's a bit of a sprint because that game will wrap up. They'll clear the ballpark and have the separate admission doubleheader. So I'm basically preparing as if it's just one long 18 inning glorious day. And I've been thinking, it's been worth the wait that our pitching matchup tonight, a couple guys by the name of Chris Sale and Zach Wheeler. So you're not going to hear any complaints from me about spending an extra day here in Philly to get that pitching matchup. Just two of the absolute best, two potential Hall of Famers, you could say, two perennial Cy Young contenders. So we'll be rewarded this evening with, I think, an outstanding pitching matchup.
Yeah, as far as doubleheaders go and having to wait for it, this ranks pretty much pretty high up there. That's nice to see. And obviously two very interesting teams here, right, mm-hmm. John? And when you look at the Braves and the way that things are, they're definitely going better than when they were here last. And that is obviously in large part thanks to Ronald Acuña Jr., who's come back and hit in every game. He hit a home run in the first pitch he saw. Just how important is his return, as well as Spencer Strider, who is still, you know, up and down a little bit, but that's to be expected. But if for the Braves to get where they want to go, how important are those two guys?
Crucial, Julia. And I think it's an important point you make about the overall arc of the Braves season. I saw them a couple times early when they were in the midst of that 0-7 stretch. And they have done a great job, I think, of bouncing back from what was a really disappointing start to the year. And it's not only was it disappointing, but at least it was easily explained because, to your point, there was no Strider. There was no Acuña. They were still trying to figure out, even behind the plate, a young Drake Baldwin, who now has become one of the best catchers in the National League. I would almost describe Drake as a really under-the-radar all-star candidate because of how good he has been this season. But you're right. They just did not have their personnel lined up. It's a tough division to play catch-up in when you consider the Phillies and the Mets. So I think the Braves have done an outstanding job of just getting back level to 500 right around the time that Acuña, of course, has come back from the injured list. And you're totally right. I actually asked a couple different Braves people today, Tim Hyers and Brian Snitker, Hyers, of course, the hitting coach. I said, which player seems to benefit the most in the lineup from Acuña being back in it in terms of maybe seeing more fastballs or just the overall energy that Acuña brings? And the answer was the same for both. All of them. So that certainly he has a big impact on everybody. And I think the Braves have already observed this. And they also have, I think, their farm system under Alex Anthopoulos has been better than maybe people thought it was, because that farm system has produced Drake Baldwin, a young Spencer Schwellenbach, a young AJ Smith-Shawver, who starts the first game today. So while they maybe don't have a gaudy number of prospects still in the minor leagues, they've got a lot of young regulars who have made a big impact on this team. And they've done some creative things with the lineup. They brought in Nick Allen now, as opposed to Arcia, and Allen just has played more consistently than Arcia did. So they've had to make some changes, and they've gotten themselves back to 500, which, as we know, for the Jays as well, if you're right around 500, at least you're in the playoff conversation. That's where the Braves are. That's where the Jays are.
Yeah, the Jays have it a little bit easier in the American League, at least, where in the National League, it's you know, there are a lot of very good teams. The American League can't say the same. You mentioned that earlier today. You also got to talk to Jordan Romano, who obviously is no longer a Toronto Blue Jay, but was here a long time, is a local product. Obviously, Toronto fans still root for him, and it's been nice to see him turn the corner a little bit, not entirely smoothly, but what was that conversation like, and where is Romano at, you know, kind of mentally after the injury and the tough start to the season?
Yeah, Blake, so I should clarify. Actually, I spoke with other relievers about Romano.
Oh, okay,
rebound.
Sorry.
I'll say that. But I did, Jordan did see me as he was coming out of the field, gave me a nice tap on the shoulder. He's always such a classy guy. I always enjoy seeing him. The pride of Markham, as we all know. But Orion Kerkering said to me that he's really impressed by the way that Jordan has adapted after having his velo down a bit early on to being more of a consistent presence now in the late innings of the bullpen. And actually, Rob Thompson himself acknowledged that maybe Romano was throwing a bit too much early on, that spacing things out a little more in terms of the early workload to help build back his velocity is something that maybe he's looked at and said, you know what, maybe we should have given him a little bit more of a more days of rest to rebuild his peak form. But the important thing now for the Phillies is that with both Kerkering and Romano going again, Matt Strom has been outstanding all season long. Yes, they're now without Alvarado for an 80-game suspension and the playoffs. That is a significant absence for them. But with Romano coming back and now Kerkering having his sweeper back in place, I think just in general, they've seen firmer stuff from Romano, commanded better. And I think, too, listen, and Rob Thompson acknowledged this. This is a competitive town. And when you step in as a new free agent and you struggle and the fans don't really know you, that can take a mental adjustment. And I think that Jordan went through a bit of a period of time where there was some getting used to with this environment here in Philly. It's a very professional place, a very professional group of players, but I just think it maybe took Jordan a bit of time to get fully settled in. But the important thing is now he's there. His teammates love what they're seeing from him. Rob Thompson does as well. And for a bullpen that's been much maligned, I think an in-form Romano and an in-form Kirkering have done a lot to address the concerns of Phillies fans.
It's such a fascinating point you make about the market and kind of, obviously, you know, Toronto is a market that gets talked about a lot for the pressure on the hockey players and what that takes mentally and things like that. And Philly is like that for every sport. Like, they throw batteries at Santa Claus at the Eagles game and stuff like that. But it's also fascinating to contrast where, you know, 2022, when this Phillies core started on the rise, it was kind of like, the vibe they gave off was like they were like the dirtbag team, like the kind of, you know, Nick Castellanos was, you know, the avatar for kind of the attitude that they had on the way up, bumping funny music after wins and things like that. Yeah. And John, I wonder what your read is on that kind of balance where, yes, you have to be serious. You have to be, you know, Bryce Harper is a professional. Kyle Schwarber is very intentional about his job, but you also have to be able to, if not filter out that noise, have some fun with it, maybe?
You do, and that's a really good point. I think that the Phillies, they remind me a little bit of a hockey team in some ways, in terms of the edge they bring and the, you want to call it swagger. There's a lot of different ways you could potentially describe that, but I think in general, it's an important detail that they have as a group of players. There's a real competitive ethic to them, and I was actually talking to Nick Castellanos about this earlier today, and Nick said that, I asked him what were some of the keys to why they've got the best record in the National League right now. And he says, Dave Dombrowski knows how to find really great players. And you think about the number of players on this club who did not originally come up with the Phillies. Basically, you know, Bohm is a draft to develop Philly, as is Stott. But for the most part, Harper, of course, was a big time signing. Castellanos was a big time signing. Schwarber, a big time signing. Realmuto, Turner, Wheeler. I mean, a lot of these players were brought in during Dombrowski's time, and he knows what it means to cultivate that type of star laden team. It's and again, it's not always the case, and we know this across different sports. It's not always the case that a star laden team is going to be a successful one. But I think the unique thing about this Phillies team is they do have a superstar mentality, but also they grind. And even Nick Castellanos talked about how Schwarber and a lot of these other players that are in the same age bracket, if you will, they're not old players, but they're veterans who have been around the game long enough to really hone in on what their routine should be and what their identity is as a player. And the more that you know your identity, whether you're a player, broadcaster, person, anybody, the more you know who you are, the easier time you have of warding off the criticism that's inevitably going to come. And I think that you've got with this group, a group that really enjoys talking baseball together. I've noticed that about their clubhouse a lot. When you walk in the clubhouse here, there's a lot of baseball talk back and forth about the game, about matchups, about players on other teams even. They love the game. And there's a certain quality to, if you really love the sport, how you present yourself to your teammates and the atmosphere that you create. And I give a lot of credit to Schwarber, too. There were times in his career he was sent down, even after that success with the Cubs. He was sent to the minor leagues. He was non-tendered by the Cubs. He had to go back to the Nationals and reprove himself. He was traded to the Red Sox, then he signed the deal with the Phillies. He has totally, from what I can tell, reshaped his body, routine, work ethic, and he is just a professional guy who I believe is going to be able to have a really long and great career in Major League Baseball. So I think it's just a very unique group of players led by the great Canadian-born manager, in Rob Thompson.
Yeah, the Schwarber topic specifically is so interesting because he hit his 300th homer and he was asked about number 500, right? Which is just absurd. But when you see just how steady the power numbers have been, you kind of start to dream about that a little bit. Mm-hmm. And for the Phillies, there's a lot to dream of, right? This is a very, very good team in a formidable National League. I know that the MLB Showcase game next week will be in LA, if I'm not mistaken, and it's Mets Dodgers, two other teams that are supposed to be the best team in the National right. League. What have you made at this point of the season, a little bit over the quarter mark here, John, about just how top heavy the NL is?
There's a real bounce of power, Julia, and you're spot on about that. It's I've seen a lot of National League games this year, and I appreciate, by the way, you checking our schedule. It means a lot to us at the network. But I've seen a lot of NL ball this year, and there's a good reason for it. There's so many superstars, so many top end teams, and the overall balance of power in the NL, I would say, Julia, is not nearly as lopsided as some thought it would be. And by that I mean the Dodgers. Hey, they're a great team, but they've had a lot of injuries. And I'm not sure what that pitching staff is going to look like in the second half. They're probably going to have to make another Jack Flaherty-type pitching move to get themselves to October. And the number of guys that they've had already go on the IL, the questions about when exactly Shohei is going to be able to pitch. They're a really good team, but they are not an unbeatable team. And I think that may be a bit of a surprise to those that describe the Dodgers being this inevitable force that was obviously going to go to the World Series. Even last year, they won. They were not inevitable. They were down 2-1 to the Padres in the first round. The Padres in some ways are just as good or better now than they were a year ago. The Mets are better. The Phillies are at least as good, maybe better. The Giants are a much better team. The Cubs are a much better team. So you've seen that you're accurately pointing out a real inflow of talent to the National League. Kyle Tucker, of course, now is playing in the NL and not the AL. So there's a land of opportunity now. If you're an American League team that makes the right moves at the right times, last I checked, the rule of the World Series still is one bid from each league. And so that whether you're the Blue Jays, whether you're the Tigers, whether you're any number of other teams in the American League, the Mariners come to mind, this is the year to be aggressive, because very rarely will you have a year in which the Astros look just okay. I still think that they're a big threat in the AL West, but they're not what they used to be. And the Tigers are a great team right now, but they're also not inevitable. The Red Sox are not what they usually are. There's the Orioles are nowhere close to being what they were last year. So there's a lot of opportunity if you get hot at the right time. And so for the Jays, and I'm sure there's Jays fans that would like to see them better than they are right now, they're a game under 500. And in the American League in 2025, a game under 500 means you are a contender.
It's so funny, like, as a lifelong Jays person, to think back to, like, I grew up on Jays teams that would win 87 games and have no chance at a playoff spot. And some of that is the extra wild card burst, but some of it is, yeah, how that balance has shifted. And the way you just laid out the NL there is, this is more of a January conversation, but it's what drove me nuts when people were mad at the Dodgers getting guy after guy after guy. And, like, I can understand not wanting one super team that's super loaded, but A, it's baseball. Like, it doesn't make you inevitable. They've won two World Series in this like 11 or 12 year era where they've been very good every year. And B, it's fun to have like a big bad to cheer against. It's fun, like when the Yankees were dynastic and everyone was kind of coming for them. I think that's good too. And if you are the Mets or the Phillies or the Padres, you get to come at the Dodgers a little bit. I think it adds an entertaining wrinkle. On the AL side, John, this is a Jay show. We got 10 minutes left. Last time you came on, Jays looked a little rosier. This time they just won a series, scoring only 4 runs against a Rangers team that we also thought would be a little bit better in the AL and haven't gotten out of first gear in the AL West. So when we shape up the AL like this, how close in your read are the Blue Jays to being able to, you know, separate themselves from that kind of, I don't know, there's like 8 teams between like 4 games under and 4 games over 500.
Schultz, Lauer, and Fisher yesterday, by the way. So some names that maybe were not exactly top of mind when the team gathered in Dunedin, really key in that win. And the Rangers, people might say, well, they're not hitting that great, and they're not. But that's a pretty impressive 3-game pitching performance for that whole series by the Jays. They easily could have won all 3 games, but the important thing was the pitching was almost immaculate throughout those 3 games. So very impressed. And I think, by the way, with Little, they have found a very valuable late inning arm that again, we weren't really sure about in spring training. So I think the Jays right now, you know, Springer has cooled off a bit. We're waiting to see more consistency from Santander. Yes, there have been flashes of better swings. I tend to think that you're going to need Santander to really step forward for this team to eventually get where they believe that they can go. And again, Bo has been okay. Vlad has been okay by their standards. Right now, you've got, at least in the lineup yesterday, I believe, both your leadoff man and your number two hitter are both bat under 200. It's just, I know we've got other analytics to point out on hitting, but that's a pretty rare thing to have this late in May that you've got your top two guys under 200. So I'm seeing enough there that that you would believe that there's a path for this team to get still to the postseason. But when you look at the overall position player group, they've brought up Barger. Clement, I think, has still done enough to merit regular playing time. I know it's not perfect, but he's still, I think, part of the core group right now. There's some certainly moves they can make, whether you bring in an extra bat. But the problem is, if you've got Santander and Vladdy occupying DH in first, you start to look around. How many elite other infield positions could you bring a player in at who would meaningfully upgrade your team? Maybe you call the Rockies about some of their position players. The Marlins would make some moves, I'm sure, at different points. The Pirates would make some moves. But how many of them are better than what you have, for sure? And I think that's where I'm a little bit questioning about it. I would actually still focus more on the pitching side of things, because if I'm the Jays, I still believe the second half of Santander, the second half of Vladdy, the second half of Bichette, the second half of probably Clement will be better than the first. So trust that they will eventually find their level. And then you probably have to more meaningfully really dig under the hood and say, what, if anything, can we get from Max Scherzer in the second half? Mm-hmm. And what does this mean for the overall burden on our pitching? I still would default to looking more at the rotation. But this is still a good team. It's a good team that, with the right performance from within, I think has a chance to have a meaningful run in the second half. And I also think this. Barger, to me, looks like an everyday position player. And we weren't really sure about exactly where his role would be when the season started. I've seen enough to say he's a guy. And I think that is an important outcome for the Jays in the first half of the season.
Yeah, we just need to see all of these things kind of string together. They had a good offense for a little
That's
bit.
It.
The starting pitching, obviously the top three in that rotation are very reliable. You get a good bullpen day yesterday, and thankfully Bo Bichette as a pinch hitter helps you out. But yeah, you just need to string a couple
Big
of
moment.
These things together. And the point I've made a bunch of times on this show over the last couple of years is they haven't had like a winning streak in a while. They haven't looked
a
like the best
one.
Team
yeah.
in baseball for 2 weeks. At any point over the last couple of years, and we're still kind of waiting for that. Maybe it starts against the Athletics this weekend. John, you've got a doubleheader to get to. Thanks so much for making time out for us.
My pleasure. And again, as you were saying that earlier about the Jays of the middle aughts, I do think if we found a way to simulate the Jays of Vernon Wells and Rios and Aaron Hill and Lyle Overbay and Johnny Mack, they'd win 92 games in the American League East right now. Bring those guys back.
I'll find a way to simulate. I'll fire up out of the park baseball after the show today, and I'll find a way to do it. I'll report back,
John. So, Blake, do that, please.
Yeah.
Circle back with me on this one. Play out a simulation. Put that, like, the 06. I'm thinking, like, the 06 Jays. There's a little bit of Frank Thomas in there.
Yeah.
Good bullpen. Like, give me the Casey Jansen, Brian Tallett. Give me that bullpen with this group and see how we do.
I'll do my best. John, thanks so much for doing this, man.
All the best. Looking forward to it. Thank you.
John Morosi of MLB Network giving me some homework.
Yeah, more work for Blake.
He comes on every 2 weeks, so I've got a little bit of time to put this one together. I do think it's something I can actually do in Out of the Park Baseball, just like copy all the players and then from like 2006 and just drop them into 2025.
The hard part is schedule.
The hard part is I got to delete all the current Blue Jays and then run all the simulations. It is funny though. We mentioned the ballpark factor. I was talking about that earlier. One of the things I did when the Blue Jays announced their new ballpark factor is I ran a bunch of simulations in Out of the Park Baseball and compared them to Mike Petriello's simulations at MLB.com when he did his.
Oh.
And we butted heads a little bit.
Really?
Look, mine was very crude. He has way better tech and stuff like that to do it. So far, though, my little video game simulation was like, it's going to be slightly pitcher friendly.
Uh-huh.
And his was slightly hitter friendly.
I was going to bet that your crude one.
Well, I wouldn't have brought it up if not.
Yeah, of course.
Also, like, there is an element, obviously, with park factors as well. And all the park factors that we talk about try to control for this. But the Blue Jays immediately, when they changed the ballpark, trade away a couple home run hitters, focus more on run prevention, got a really solid rotation. So you can control for those things and do your best at it. But it probably still takes a little bit of time to strip out that you were a lighter hitting team that had a really good rotation for the first couple of years in the new ballpark environment. And they keep tweaking all the foul grounds and stuff like that. One day we'll know, and then they'll change it. All again. Tonight, we know it'll be Jacob Lopez against Jose Berríos. We set you up with Lopez's scouting report a little earlier. Jose Berríos looking to string a couple good ones together. He's kind of danced around trouble a lot this year. We'll see what the Blue Jays lineup look like. By the way, we had kicked around the possibility of maybe a right-handed bat coming up for this series. The Buffalo Bisons are in the first leg of a doubleheader right now in Buffalo, and all the usuals are playing, so nothing is imminent. But you could get to Buffalo between three from Buffalo to Toronto from like 2:30 to 7 o'clock. So we'll keep an eye on that. We'll keep an eye on everything, and we will be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break it all down for you. Blair and Barker will have 4 to 6 and post game for you as usual. I'll be down at the park. You're not down at the park for this
not
one,
not today,
right? No. All right. Thanks to Jake Mintz, John Morosi, and Jessica Kleinschmidt for joining us. Thank you to Amit Mon, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick. Behind the glass, have a wonderful Thursday. Talk to you tomorrow.